In December 1987, Paulo Freire, the renowned Brazilian educator and philosopher, spent a week at Highlander Folk School in Newmarket, Tennessee, talking a book with its founder, Miles Horton. On Saturday, December 5th, Freire and Horton shared experiences with students in adult education from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and with some of the many community activists from across Appalachia who have been inspired and guided by Highlander's leadership. This is a brief excerpt from the proceedings of that day.
I'm from North Carolina, the first county over, Madison County, and I'm happy to be here. Winona. And I did work with continuing education students in the night program. On that one. My name is Tanya Dorman, and I'm from Maryville. And just to throw this in, I graduated my master's on Friday. I'm really interested in getting in something with adult education, and I think today is a very good place to start. I'm glad to be here.
My Walt Douglas from Maryville, Tennessee, associated with the Aluminum Company of America, and I'm vice chairman of our local unit there that has to deal with the mentally retarded children.
My name is Dennis Minett. I am in charge of the Tennessee Valley Authority's Education and Skills Training Programs, working with educational institutions and industries throughout the Valley region. A doctoral student, main reason I'm up here, I told Mr. Horton last night, my oldest sister was early on involved in the Civil Rights Movement. I was way before my time, but growing up in Knoxville, I always heard about a Highlander, two things about it. From the civil rights perspective, it was one of the greatest places in the world, or it was nothing but a communist cell. So when I found out we was going to be up here, I really jumped at the opportunity to come up here and more or less to be a part of history, to see what was going on, and to see from my own perspective what was fact and what was fiction.
I'm P.F. Struiken from the Netherlands, and I've been working at Highlander with the summer youth workshop they have here with teenagers from the southern and Appalachian states, and worked in Dungannon with the children camp.
Because the 20 graduate students from the University of Tennessee had a great deal of practical field experience to share, the concerns they brought to Freire and Horton were much the same as those brought by the 10 community activists.
I'm Maxine Waller. I'm from Ivanhoe, Virginia. We live in a small, dying mountain town. And the first thing we found out, we had to have education to do anything. So we have a literacy program trying to kick off right now, and a GED program trying to kick off now, but we found out it's unpopular education. They don't want mountain people and poor people to get educated. So we're having a lot of problems, but Helen's helping us, and Highlander's helping us, and we're going that way.
I'm Miles Horton. I'm here to learn with you and Paolo new things.
Me too.
You killed the mic.
I discovered the reason the coup d'etat in Brazil had to put me in jail.
I'm Paulo Freire, I'm from Brazil. This is my first time here, and I'm very happy to be here. Of course, I knew what this center, this exceptional center, has done in this country. But this is we met together more than 10 years ago for the first time. We have met constantly. And now I am here mainly to speak a book with Miles. That is, we are engaged in a process of a dialogue. We already taped 7 hours. Our friend smiled because I'm making the calculation of the hours. And
I am very happy to be with you. I would like very much to listen to you this morning, the afternoon, speaking about your experience. Today I would like much more to listen than to speak.
After this session, the introductions, what we had hoped is that people would go briefly into a small group activity where you will create a drawing. And it'll be a drawing that characterizes what community adult education is as you know it. And it will also be a drawing that'll have a second frame that will characterize what your dream is, what your vision is for community adult education.
It's Marshall College.
But you're in a unique situation.
Yes.
You're not a public state institution.
No.
You're private.
We're private.
That's what we are. Yes.
Well,
that training cannot translate into that company showing a profit. And that's when you start talking about in times of budget crunch, the very first thing to go, they're gonna give hard scrutiny to training. I think that's unfair.
Okay,
but it's
so training is dependent not only on the CEO, but also on the budget constraints.
It's on how well the CEO sees that training is translating back into increased productivity.
You need to put dollar signs up there with the CEO.
There's a slew of good ideas about what we need to do and what's needed out there. But the bottom line inevitably comes down to, that's a great idea, but now as he goes to talk to somebody, can we afford it?
That's right.
What budget constraints are we operating
on? And what's our return?
And where would the worker be if he did not have these entrepreneurials?
You know, tradition.
Where would we be? That might be the point. We might be as well off.
We are interdependent on each other.
Only because we've created the system.
Power.
Therefore, make the money decisions. Okay, how about book decisions? They're making the curriculum decisions too.
Money. Dollars. That's power. Big dollars. Power. They control our money. Power. Okay, now we got to hurry up and draw the other one because we got to draw what we want it to look like. This is what it looks like now.
Could you just explain to us what the different symbols mean?
This is our school system that's out of our reach now. And this is the people that's in charge of it, and they're oppressing our children with XYZ, which means nothing. It means that our children can only stay as laborers. They can never go advance. People says you can do anything, but we know better. This is our school, which is a 12 by 12 room, and in our school we teach ABC, which is anybody can. And we have 12 by 12 room, and we have 17 people sometime at one time trying to study. And we're having a real lot of problems with our people, and everybody's trying to get in. And then this is a skilled person in our neighborhood that knows everything. You know, they could teach somebody if they only knew that they could. Then we have some people in our community that are blind to the fact that we need education. Some people are half blind, and then some people all at once can see, and they go running down to our education center. This is Dot, our coordinator, and that's a book, because every time I see her, she's got a book, and she's hollering, come on, come on, we gotta hurry. And this is me, and that's my fist, because I'm always having to fight somebody. And this is some people in our community that all they do is talk about us and say, oh, just look at them people, they don't know what they're doing. They can't do that. Why are they doing that? Look at them. They're nothing. They're going to fall down. But if we do, it's all right. And this is the wonderfulest man that I've ever met in my life. And this is Miles Horton. And he's a billy goat. Because he's just like a big wise billy goat that sits up here on this hill. And he's got his big horns and his beard hanging down. And he's just grinning. Because you see, he's seen that we had a vision. And he's looked over at us and he's so happy. And see his rocking chair. And that's Highlander Center. And see the star on it. And this is our new building that we're not allowed to come into yet. Because we don't have any heat. This don't have a sewage system. And the mine sunk part of our town. So even our toilet fell in. So we don't have any books or anything to go down there with, but we're going. And we're going to open it up in January. No heat, no plumbing, but we're going anyway. And this is Linda Martin with the SALT program. And she's taught us so much.
And this is Jane Sapp here at Highlander Center, and she sings beautiful. And this is Hubert Sapp, because he's got a big fat belly, because he's a big sugar bear. And he's just a sweetheart. And this is Barbara Green from Mountain Woman's Exchange, and she's saying, go get him, go get him. And this is John Gavenna. And every time I see him, he's got a paper or a book in his hand, and he's going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he goes, ah, ah, ah. So this is Vicki Creed, and she's with the stop program, and she's going, go get him, go get him. And this is Helen Lewis. And Helen's over here, and she's come over here, and she's just... They're just ecstatic because some people have found some power like we found in our community. And this is our courthouses. We're two courthouses, two counties. This is Wythe County, and this is Carroll County. And they have a lot of power, and they're in charge of money. And they're part of them is asleep, but they've still got the great gavel of justice. Even asleep, they still control and still have power. And that is Ivanhoe, Virginia, USA. And we love it. There's some women here in the bedroom if you want to do the Mountain Women's Exchange.
Oh, ho, maybe we should do that.
You're going to enroll me in art school when I get out of here, right?
The most significant thing about this event yesterday is that it was happening at the University of Tennessee. And not only was he there in that wonderful audience and group of activists there, but you were there. And isn't it true that people who were associated with Highlander at UT lost their jobs and were threatened and so on?
Yeah, there have been people fired from UT for coming to Highlander. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of a new day when I'd have that kind of reception at and officially. I mean,
you've been back to classes, but this is the first time you've been invited back to a public.
I've been to many classes there. Friends, people, especially the heads of departments who were friends of mine who had tenure.
Right.
But some of the younger people who came to Highlander were fired because they came to Highlander.
I'm glad everybody's having such a good time. That's great. That's exactly what we wanted to have happen. So, just to say it again, what we're going to do is have each group come up, put the picture up here, tape it up, and then you all tell your story, okay? And we're going to hear from hopefully all of the groups before lunch. The rest of the day is to be spent then really looking in depth at the pictures. We may come back to one and really deal with it in a lot of depth. And
I myself lived in a housing project for 8 years. And so, you know, I mean, I got firsthand knowledge of what goes on there. I myself am a product of continuing education. I dropped out of school in seventh grade. So I went back to school through continuing education. This type of continuing education, which was very hard, you know, the ABE route, volunteer literacy thing. Okay, this is a whole different concept of adult literacy, in the sense that it's situated where I think the masses are, where the powerless people are that don't have no control over their lives, and it's simply because they don't have any education, is in housing projects.
But this is Dungannon, down here. The center of the education is a depot, which is where we have college classes and GED classes. Now, these classes are organized by the community, but they're administered by the college, community college, which is up here, about an hour away on this road.
This is where a lot of our money and constraints come from. And some of these constraints people aren't telling us what to do, but for instance, the GED test. A lot of what we do is structured around the GED test because people want to pass the GED test. And so it affects us a lot, even though it doesn't, you know, say you have to do this. We...
It clouds. They hang.
Yeah. So these are their, this is their influence. Also, the law by color idea of how you do literacy. The whole big, this is an illiterate hillbilly on the television, which is what you see a whole lot of. Churches, media, foundations, university, in this case Vanderbilt, all those people have affected us a lot of ways without us having any much way to go back up. Our vision here was a more integrated, I guess, kind of community with continuation of classes, sort of more mainline academic classes, if people want a class in something.
that those classes...
Pre-university.
Yeah, that there would be classes that people could take, but there would also be a whole community learning center that would be have an adult learning center, would have child care, would have parent support, would have a library, would have encouraged crafts and arts in all kinds of ways. And there would be an adult learning center that wouldn't be structured around classes, per se, and it would interact with the school, the public school, and the high school, which we didn't even have another picture, it's sort of far off, and with the college, and that there would that this would be a much more open kind of relationship than it is now. We have a van, we have ways of getting people to the center, that we'd have a factory set up that would be a community factory that would be putting money back into all this projects, as well as putting money into the community and giving people jobs.
But now, you are speaking precisely about the dream, no? Mm-hmm. Well, yes, this part now. My question is, are these dreams yours, or are also being dreams of the community which you are grasping? Because if it is your dream, maybe you cannot realize. If it is your dream, or the dream of the team, it does not mean that your dream or your dreams could not be shared. Yet shared with the community. It should be one of the tasks of the educator exactly to share the dreams with the people. And then in some moment the people would get the dreams in such a way that the dreams would belong also to the people. This is one of the tasks of the educators. Sometimes the educators don't need to share the dream starting from them, educators, but share the dream because the people challenge the educators to get their dreams as the dreams of the educators. This is my question. At this moment, these dreams you are speaking about are being discussed, are being looked for. The people are being drawn by the people also, the community, I say.
Not literally drawn, but pieces of this dream are
certainly being talked about and thought about. I guess we, the three of us, pulled it in this picture today, yes, that there are pieces of this. The need to open the school and get in the school is really strongly felt.
The need for child care is really strongly felt. The need for transportation. So some of these pieces are part of a dream. Now, we as part of the DDC have probably not sat down and dreamed as a group enough. Beyond what are we going to do tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, and the next day, instead of saying, you know, what is our whole dream? And I don't think we've done that enough, which makes it sometimes hard to tell where you're going.
Are you, as teams and the educators and also the community, becoming interested in understanding historically and politically and ideologically the reasons why these dreams are not yet realized? In other words, are you discovering the obvious thing that you are also third world? Do you see that is... Do the people the courage of recognizing that they are third world, and it means that it is important for the people to go beyond the very ideological understanding of third world? Because for many people in the first, the third is over there, but the third is inside of the first. And it is important that the third world people inside of the first one day assume themselves as third world, that is, as oppressed and exploited people.
I think that there is, and Helen, you should add into this, but it seems to me that people, that there is in this community a sense of being part of the third world.
Yeah.
But the solution that a lot of people would see is to try to pull ourselves into the first world.
Yes.
And that's how the solution is being defined now.
And not to change the first. But I think that it is obvious also, because the question is to know how the educators work. Because of that, I insist in such a way on understanding education as politics. You see, if we forget that, how can we deal with this? Because this moment now is not a pedagogical one. No techniques in education, no methods in education to confront this question. This is a political question and an ideological question, you see. But it's very interesting. No, you gave me the answers I needed.
I think it's politics. I mean, I agree that it's politics, because what I try to show the people that lives in public housing is that, you know, people sit up and jump up and down about them being indolent and on welfare and food stamps, but they're steady giving them the food stamps and the welfare, but nobody is trying to do anything about their education to get them off the welfare. And it is political. They don't want to give them the power of education to come off of these kind of services. Yes. So it is politics, and you can only look at it as politics, I think.
May I suggest that in view of the, I like to call it the Hortonian philosophy.
You sound like a bugle or something.
Well, there's a certain amount of horn tooting anytime anybody speaks. But it's become what I call the Highlander theory. Now, perhaps what you should do, this is a suggestion, is take your own circle here and become active and do these things that you see that need to be done yourselves, rather than wait for the outside folks to come in and do it for you, and then you become your own political entity.
What I was getting at, I'm agreeing with Walt here, I don't know what that means.
I've been made a radical, and it's not fair. Because it's not fair. And Paulo, you talked about being, do you realize that's third world? Well, I didn't think anybody else realized that was third world, so I've been calling myself fourth world. Because I knew that we're not the American system. The dream that everybody goes around doing shows on TV with the flag waving and all that. And up until about a week ago, the first thing I wanted to do was wave the flag, because I was so proud I was an American. And then I was made an out-and-out radical, all over my soul, from the bottom of my feet to the top of my head. And I don't want power, and I don't want anybody else to have power. I want people to be in control. So what happened in our community is, we have a school system, the great American school system, the flag. And it's out of our town. And there's barriers to get there. But here is the school system, the people that are in charge, and that's the gavel, the great gavel of justice. And that's our children. They're not in our community because consolidation pulled them out, because everybody knows bigger's better. And they teach X, Y, Z, which is, you can work in factories, you can draw welfare, and you can become alcoholics, and you can become drug addicts, but you can't ever hold the gavel of justice, because that's our job. And they drive it down into our children every day, pour it into them, beat it down into them, that they can't do any better in life. Then they put on television that, oh, this is America, you can do so many wonderful things. But anyway, now, we got so engrossed in the other picture, we didn't have time to add a lot of pictures to this one. Because we were so engrossed with what's happening right now that we knew what we want in the future, but it's going to be a while in coming. Because when we get done, we don't want anybody to have control in Ivanhoe but Ivanhoe, the people of Ivanhoe. So we'll have Ivanhoe Technical Education Center. And the reason it's going to be technical is because it's not going to learn you to read and write. It's going to learn you to live, or teach you to live, and you can do whatever with it. You enable yourself to do it. And this is Doc. And she's, her life's dream is to go be there at the center and to have her hands out to people to come in. And if you notice the other one, we didn't have any children in our community. But here we have the children in the education center, and all of our people are inside. They're learning what they want to learn and what they need to learn. And also, to be self-sufficient, we have a store beside of our education center that will be a craft store and a thrift store, and that would keep it to pay its own way, because we feel like if they give us money from outside, then they are going to want power from outside. We really don't want that. We want power ourselves. And God's in our picture, because everything we've done in Ivanhoe has been, went back through the scriptures. And Project Time stands for Teach Ivanhoe More Education, and that came from the third chapter of Leviticus. There is a time under everything, under God's heaven for everything. And this is the Highlander group again. This is Helen's hair. And see, they're just, you know, all kind of back looking. But we realize that everybody's not going to have our vision, and our dreams are not going to become everybody's dream. So there is always going to be a small barrier between some people and some other people. There'll always be that. That's called natural human conflict. That's normal. The first thing you got to realize that to fight and fuss is normal.
Obviously, Bernie, the artist in our group, what we were trying to show, and you know, as I've been hearing from other people in the group, it's become quite clear to me that these are really small pictures, and we're trying to capsulize what's going on in our communities in a real short time.
In terms of Mount Wood Exchange's empowerment work and popular education, community education work, we relate to the town council in Jellicoe, which is this little guy. All these people in these institutions, by the way, are little guys.
Okay, and this is our vision. And we have, what Ann was describing to you is what has come to be known now as the circle model of development. It's not a new idea, it's an old idea. It's just an experiment of how it works within each community, because I think it's going to be different in each community how it works. For us, it's around the theme of our organization and our commitment to working in the mountains, and that is the bread and roses, which some of you are familiar with. Those of you who aren't, it's taken from a song that was done during the unionizing of textile mills. And the bread is simply what we fight for. That is the jobs, that is the education that we need. It's anything that it takes for us to be here, be alive. And the roses, of course, is what makes us grow, what makes our spirits grow, what gives us the ability to be with each other in a different way than experience or society has taught us that is right or wrong to do. So this is wheat, believe it or not. No, that's roses. This is bread. And what we see is all these people are not straggling around out here as individuals necessarily anymore, although they are still individuals in their own right. They still have their own dreams and visions. but somehow they're connected to all of this other activity that's going on. And this time you see the court, the courthouse, the town council, the herb project, the theater, the adult basic education, the school board, Mountain Women's Exchange, the college program, and the community. They're kind of sitting on this circle. And it's some sort of a collaboration about this vision and how we want to go. And it's not just pieces where we relate to one institution in one way and another institution in another way, but there is some sort of method about what empowerment is in the community and about what, how education is really going to facilitate that happening.
As I am the eldest, I speak first. Look, what can an educator like me, a common man who loves, above all, I have the impression that I know something because I love everything. What can I say to you after seeing and hearing what I saw and heard here this morning? First of all, I have to make clear that I could not leave Highlanders without meeting with all of you. It should be wrong. In order for me to learn better all the things I have learned about Highlanders. Secondly, I would like, and now as a man who loves and who dies every day, the permanent attempt to think of what I do, it is, for me it's impossible to have practice without thinking of the practice constantly. In other words, for me, it's impossible to separate practice from theory. It's impossible to dichotomize action from reflection. It is thinking about what we do that we prepare ourselves to do better what we did before. And I would like to say to you that you gave this morning a fantastic example to the academics. That is, how is it possible to get knowledge, to go beyond the common sense without necessarily reading books and papers? And we also had the reference to this mixture, excellent mixture between being a good scholar and working on in the basis. Who is you? But we had here this morning, and I think that we will continue to have in the afternoon, this beautiful example. It's how the communities and the four people who spoke demonstrated it very clearly, how the communities have learned how to know better through thinking about what they do. And here, all of you insisted on speaking about the analysis, you know, and the results of analysis. And the analysis you were speaking about are precisely the critical reflection that you are exercising on not exclusively your experience as educators, but the reflection on the global community, that is how the community is working inside of itself and in its relationships with the greatest totality from which the community, the small community, or in which the small community is located. In the last analysis, you gave us a very important example of how to relate practice with theory. And we don't have any reason to be afraid of theory. The theory is also this. The theory of your action is coming up. Is being unveiled through the reflection you are making on practice. That is, in a first moment you act, in a second moment, I say first and second, but not. I would not like to separate the first from the second. It is a process. I said this in a second moment, just using a methodological language. Sometimes we need to split the totality just in order to grasp the totality. That is, I cannot grasp the totality if I don't split it. Afterwards, what I have to do is re-totalize the totality which I split. This is the going and the coming in the act of knowing. And you are doing that without having made yet a PhD. No. That is, it is possible to be done. Do you see? That is, the academics should begin to believe in the possibility of knowing outside of the academy. Look, I am also an academic. I am not trying to diminish the value of the academy. But what I would like is that the academy also recognize the value of those who are not inside of it, but who are also creating knowledge and doing beautiful things. And now you demonstrated that you also do that. That is, you get distance from your own action, which becomes the object of your curiosity, and then in getting distance from the object of your curiosity, this object becomes object of knowledge for you, and then you exercise on it an act of knowing. And more, you are re-knowing what you already knew yesterday. And this is this permanent reflexive act makes possible for you more to get or to have better practice. But in thinking about what you did yesterday, possibly you will do something better Monday. And this is what is happening. And unfortunately, this is not what happens inside of the academies. Because in the academies, we get such a distance from the concreteness that in some moment, the concept which or whose task, the concept has the task of mediating the understanding of the concreteness, abstractically. This is the task of the concept, in the history of the concept. But we sometimes, and many times in the academies, we get such a distance from the reality that in some moment, we lose the epistemological address. That is, we get lost, and then we know nothing but reading texts. And it, for me, it is a disaster. Then it is not theory which is wrong. What is wrong is theoreticism. This is what is wrong. But theory is fantastic. Today we had theory here. No. You are initiating your theoretical reflection. What I would like to say in finishing my comments is that, first of all, I don't say what I'm saying to you because I think that in being this man named Paulo Freire, I am giving support to you. No, no, far from me this idea. I am getting support from you. That is, right now I am reconfirming some old ideas I have had. No, that is, I am saying to myself, I was right. Thank you. This is what I would like to tell you.
Wonderful. I think a wonderful experience for all of us. Since we announced that we were going to be discussing education for social change, I would like to suggest that as we continue what we're doing, we start thinking a little bit about where we are in the progression. A lot of things that we're involved in, and all of us are involved in at times, are social services, meeting the needs of people that we think we can help, simply because of humanitarian concerns. Some of the things we've been talking about may start with that or border on it. But much of what we've talked about today, it has to do with trying to reform the practices in our communities, in our states, or in our government, so they will serve people better, so they'll give people access to making decisions. Much needed reforms and a step beyond just providing services without being concerned about improving society. But if we're going to change society, we have to take a step further, and that is deal with structural changes that make the reforms now necessary. Without that last step, we aren't bringing about social change. What we're doing, we're reforming the system to make it more palatable, to strengthen it, to make it more humane. But if we're about social change, we have to move further. Now, in some of the things we've talked about today, there are all three of these elements already, see? And some social service, there's some limited reforms, try to make the system work better, and there's some extension into the question of the nature of society, that and the need for dealing with structural changes. So I'd like it to keep in mind as we proceed, just not to necessarily say anything about those things, but try to see if any of these elements predominate or how fast we are moving towards bringing about social change. That just is one additional way of looking at what we're doing. And then we can discuss that later on.
discussions over lunch, questions arose that Paolo Ferri and Niles Horton were asked to address as the afternoon session began.
I made those brief statements and kind of parting shot, somebody said, right before we closed, and there seemed to be a little confusion. I wasn't suggesting that that everybody had to work for social change or was committed to social change. A lot of people are committed to service. The other end of the statement, several people have raised the question about what's the difference between social change and somebody says change of heart,
or improving the practices, like in communities where we have bad people carrying out bad practices. If we can just get rid of those bad people, then that's the vision, so to speak. We know that the system produces bad people, but we think it's impossible to change that system that produces those bad people. So what I was talking about is our looking from now on, along with other things, as to whether what category roughly it fits. Is it a service because people are needy? Is it a reform to try to make the practices better without changing the institutions and structures? Or is it concerned with what I call structural change, that is dealing with the structures of society, including the governmental structures?
But vis-a-vis this, I think that as educators and politicians, we have to recognize that, first, there are times in history in which we just can do reforms. Secondly, even though the people who are doing reforms are reformists or have a radical dream in making reforms, it's possible that the reforms provoke deepened reforms tomorrow, and then what was at the beginning the dream of keeping the system becomes radical transformation of the system. What do I want to say with this is that once the reform is starting, it also can escape from the hands of those who started making the reforms. Even though they are reformists or not. But because of that, I am not afraid of reforms, as I know lots of people in a very good position in Latin America who always speak against reforms as if it were not possible for us to take advantage of some reforms made in order to keep the system like the system is. And in spite of that, the reforms end up by provoking a much more deepened transformation in society.
50 years ago, a young, very, very young man in this country started this kind of reaction here. Of course, by doing that, he knew at that time, and he knows better today, that he was not really transforming the structures of society, of his society. But he knew at that time, as well as he knows today, that even though he is a humble man, and all of you are doing lots of important things in the historical process of transformation of the society.
In history, we don't have exclusively big actions
but all the actions can be important. It depends on the way how we engage ourselves in, and we are consistent. We put together our dream and our action. We diminish the distance between what we say and what we do.
Until now, you are trying to make some reforms inside of the power relationships in your small communities. But it's possible that in some moment, the people get into the hands, and then something more deep can happen. I think that this is with this objective that you are here and you are working in your communities. Okay.
Thank you. Now you understand. I should have said that some people try to do things that move in the direction of structural change, radical change, and some do things that move in the direction of reinforcing the system and not changing the system.
But even these, if these reforms which are made in the order to keep the system, can escape from the hands of those who made it.
I see, for example, we saw that in Latin America in different countries. No, in different countries. For example, a certain rightist party in power starts a process of reform with a reformist objective, and suddenly the mere reform, because look, there is not a reform in the air. The reform is something which is made inside of history and socially and culturally. Then the reform envelops people. And the reform can change the mind of the people. The reform can clarify better the exploiting situation in which the people are. Then instead of making the people more silent, sometimes a reform developed with this objective awakes the people. Do you see? Then those who make the reform never can be so secure,
because it can escape from the hands. But it's better to start making reforms knowing that we really want to go beyond the reforms.
You're pretty much within the system when you're looking to take advantage of an internally generated reform. You're in the system. You're committed to being in the system then.
No, I am not committed to the system, but I am inside of the system.
You're committed to being inside of it, whether you...
Yeah, because look, first of all, I think that all of us here are inside
of
the system.
No, where else to be?
There is no place to be.
Well, there was a distinction the other day about Miles being outside of it in the sense that he didn't...
Yeah, the subsystem, yes. No,
that's Miles, a subsystem of education.
Of the subsystem of education. He started since the beginning, out of the subsystem, but inside of the global system.
Oh, yeah.
What we are
living. Unless we can get the space flight, I don't know where else to go.
Well, the kind of thing we're doing this morning.
A good one in this country of a system generated reform that got out of the hands of the system and created a structural change.
Bureaucracy.
Well, I mean, was it a civil rights?
No, I think
kind of an example.
When Franklin D. Roosevelt set out to revive and preserve the capitalist system, which was on the rocks, thanks to Mr. Hoover, and to the system, and he tried to get the manufacturers people who employed people to pay better wages to get money in circulation instead of coming down from the drip system from the top, you know, the Reagan theory. He thought it should be in the hands of the people. Money should be in that created buying power and that the system going. And he tried a system of trying to get them voluntarily to do that, and they wouldn't do it. And after floundering around a while, he figured the only way to get them to do it was to force them to do it by encouraging workers to organize and bring pressure. And he provided the framework in which unions could be organized. Now, his interest was not labor movement. His interest was not putting power in the hands of the labor. His interest is in getting the system working.
Oh, okay, so then you utilize that.
Then what happened was that on the basis of that, the industrial union movement grew up, which took things in its own hands and went beyond what Roosevelt had in mind and got powerful so powerful to the extent that Roosevelt says, curse on both your houses, labor and capital are the same. Now, in other words, I think that's a kind of an example of what you're talking about, where something that's, you know, starts out one way kind of ends up another way.
Yeah.
You notice, first of all, they gave us smaller paper. We're a group of adult basic educators, we hope, and other people who are interested in adult basic education. And first of all, I want to say that we feel, after listening to you people this morning, I don't want to say we feel worthless, but that's how we feel. But I do want to emphasize the fact that we sure learned a lot from you, and that I feel like we're rebels too. Yeah, I share what you're saying, because although we're kind of in the system and kind of half in and half out, most of us, because we're students and we're working at different jobs too with concerning education. Okay, this is a symbol of mainly the Knox County basic education system, with this little slash up here, which represents another basic education system. You notice we've used a lot of color too. I don't know why, but we thought it was neat. Anyway, we'll start right here with showing that we feel like we're under this. This is a thumb. We couldn't decide whose thumb it was. The system's thumb, bureaucracy's thumb. And under that thumb, we have the U.S. government, we have the state government of Tennessee. And we have people there, they probably can't see from back there, but they're puppets. They're manipulated, we feel like, from whoever this thumb is, though we're not sure. This is my program right here, which is part of, I've got some orange, I'm on the University of Tennessee campus, and she helps me with volunteers and help and materials. And the people I work with are prisoners. And so I'm showing them right here. This is the city county building with the jail in it. And the judge who has the power to say yes or no to whether we accept people in our program, whether they can come or not. And this is the sheriff, this badge of authority here. And if they come to our program, they're still, in a way, in prison. They're sentenced to our program. We are a punishment. And I feel like my part of the program is the only part that isn't a punishment, I hope. But in a way, even it is, because they have to come to our program. If they don't have their GED, they have to come to my program. Then my challenge becomes, can I make them want to be there? Can we learn together? And it's a real challenge, and it's real exciting.
Before you go on to your dream, I have a problem with the program you have and the one that lady have with all the money.
Okay.
And that's our problem. Those are the people that get all the money. But my problem with your program is, you say that inmates are, you know, they're made to come to your program.
They are sentenced.
Sentenced, okay, yeah, because the same thing happened at my institution. I work for prison, me in prison. But my thing is, why? I mean, you know, what good is it to sentence somebody that's reading on a second grade level? And if the GED is anything like it was when I took it, you got to have a 12th grade education to be able to read the thing.
Right.
You know, so what are they benefiting out of being sentenced to come study for a GED?
Well, because
some of them can't read at all.
The benefit is because I'm a teacher.
Yeah, but they can't read.
Just a minute. And I am arranging one-on-one tutors. That's one way I'm working with Lana, is I'm not just going in there and teaching them to pass a test. I'm trying to teach them like we teach here, and we're using one-on-one tutors. We're using a lot of different methods for them to get involved. They set their own
goals.
Oh,
maybe I got something wrong. They're not studying for the GED. You're teaching them how to read.
Some of them are. But their sentence says they will attend my GED class.
So the judge probably doesn't really know what you're doing or give a damn.
We have two judges that do care. We have one judge that doesn't care. And we tried to do a lot of educating with the judges and with lawyers in town about our program.
Okay. What I'm saying is that it seems to me that your flexibility is unusual. That as you're not being confined, because it seems to me like my experience with accounting for money for any program that we're trying to do in the community is numbers. How many GEDs do people get? You know, how many people are in this class?
I don't get any money, except I get paid for teaching a GED class. But as far as supplies and that kind of thing, that's what I have. That's what I and the students work out.
But the program is getting some money. Somebody's getting some money.
The program's getting the money.
Okay. So what I'm saying is that your flexibility in that is a unique situation.
It is.
It's very unique. And that it says to me that the system, I think, is allowed to make the decisions about who does and who doesn't go in there,
right.
But that's not an appropriate place for the decision to get made. I don't know. I was just like,
legally, it's the only way it can get made right now, the way the system's set up. And probably the freedom is due to the fact that I keep my mouth shut.
Amen. That's what I'm talking about.
About some of the things.
You know,
I don't feel like I'm
breaking into a little education on the side.
I am Eddie Butler. I am with the higher education group. All of us are associated with either colleges or universities. I had a good mix. I had some private, two private schools, two of us associated with the university. I started out with this, and you're probably confused, and so was the group. And that's exactly what we think the situation is. It's totally confused. And then I went to get a cup of coffee, and so they redrew my plan. Really. Let me just give you some basic foundations, and we'll move out. Okay, our concept, or the way we look at it, and probably we're in a minority, again, because we're up here. We're in a minority because we see a possibility of a relationship between the university, the college, and the community. But the situation that we drew in reality is that, in general, higher education is on an island, or at least has a moat around it, which probably fits better in the traditional sense. Higher education is generally, this green here is ivy-covered palaces, okay? Higher education, the halls. Essentially, what we determined in the group was that in most of the money decisions came from the university level or the college level as to where community education got funded. Community education programs, adult education programs, generally decisions were made at the university to go out. Y'all were referencing this morning about a couple of you mentioned, you know, the fact that somebody up here says we'll come down and tell you your problems. Well, essentially what we've got existing is the fact that either the university and college sense a need or somebody brings them a need, and then they determine, well, is this worth funding? You know, are we going to get our name or whatever? And so the point is, we've got a couple of bridges across this moat between the real world out here and the university. We have the community, we have the industrial business complex, and again, they're all involved, but to a limited degree. We see that the funding is going to the big orange state, and then the big orange decides where the funding comes down. And again, in today's situation, it generally comes to the universities and college programs, and then the college divvies it out as they see fit. The businesses are involved with training. Some of the trained workers are inside here. This fence keeps a lot of the community out because, again, they're not trained due to whatever, illiteracy or anything else. And so there again, we think there are certain programs involved. And somebody was up here on a cloud. I forget who that was. But, okay. Any questions about the current? Moving right ahead.
I'm John, and I was with the group that was looking at industrial training. And I want to comment that none of us that were in that group worked for the same company. We all worked for different organizations. But I was rather surprised by how quickly we came to a consensus about what the nature of the beast really is in regard to this drawing we have here. This is our understanding of what our system is. And at the very top, you'll see a little box up here. It doesn't look right here, but if you were actually there, you'd find these are mahogany desks and very plush carpets and very nice atmosphere. That's where the chief executive officers are of our organizations. And they are sheltered from everything else that's going on below by a series of insulation that we'll find here at different levels of the organization. So they don't see very much of what's happening down here, but they do pay a lot of attention to the politics, and they control a lot of the politics. They pay a lot of attention to what's going on within the tradition of the rest of the industrial network. We don't think that any company kind of exists on its own, but it is responding to and moving along with what is happening in other corporations around the country. We have another layer here where there are groups of managers who work together. There's someone over here who's working on financial issues, watching the stock market very closely over here, and other executives. And then we have a whole line of middle managers here, and we're not exactly sure what they do. But one thing we know that they do is that they absorb information as it goes up the line, so that not very much of it gets very far up. Now, down here, we have the factory floor. It doesn't really matter what the factory is. The factory floors are all about the same. And over here, we have the products that are being spewed forth, whether they're automobiles, TV sets, or whatever it may be. Now, where are we as the traders in this picture? Well, we're this little group that's sitting around this table here. And the interesting thing to me is that about 15 years ago, if you were to come to this factory, you wouldn't find very much over here. That this is a relatively new phenomenon. And these people up here want this because they want to do things to improve the rate at which stuff's going to spew out here. But at the same time, they're rather uncomfortable with us as a group. And frankly, we scare the hell out of them sometimes in regard to the kinds of things that we talk about.
Well, I'll start over here where, let me just give you the general impression first. We, all of us, mainly work in or near Highlander, and so the circle in some ways represents our large, both the circle that we're in now in terms of how we work and the larger community in which we work. So within this circle, we've drawn a fairly large community that we work in. Let me just explain part of this over here, and then Mario can do the rest. I at least have, am partly in this circle sometimes now and partly outside this circle. And I'm up here. This represents a sort of multicultural society that Mario and I are part of at the Center for International Education at UMass. Also, this part of this drawing is fairly important to a lot of us in the room, and especially to those of us who have been in Highlander. This is our connection to Nicaragua. And for the past several years, Highlander has been going back and forth and doing several exchange programs with Nicaragua. And this says, reading the word and reading the world. And I think that's a lot of what we've learned from Nicaragua in terms of literacy, that teaching literacy is also a reading of people's world and helping to translate that world to people.
We have a wonderful opportunity here that we don't have much time to take advantage of. What if there's some questions you'd like to, in closing, or ask to get Paul, ask Paul already gave to comment on some of the things that you said.
I'm interested in one question in regard to your ideas about theology and its impact, especially a comment that was by the author or that did the introduction to the politics of education, where he said that God is a God of history and that true Christian principles, at least what I got from this, was that true Christian principles cannot coincide with oppression or that was what it said. And I guess my question is about churches, organized churches in this country, and the struggle that I have with some of that.
I think that you have nothing to do but to be in struggle with many kinds of churches, which represent precisely tremendous contradiction with the deliberating proposal of the Gospels, for example. Then I think that it's better to be with God than and with Christ than to be with the churches, no?
Yes. I think this is exactly the crux of the struggle.
Yes, that's the question. That is, you know, I am more or less in peace concerning all these things. It's very interesting. I have my faith. When I was very, very young, maybe 18 years old, 19 years old, I read a beautiful book by the idealist Spanish philosopher and great writer, Unamuno,
oh, yeah.
Miguel de Unamuno, Beliefs and the Ideas, the title of the Ideas and Beliefs, the title of the book. And at the beginning of the first chapter, he says, the ideas we have, that's I am translating directly into English from Spanish, the ideas we have in the beliefs we are. Maybe the syntax is not good in English, but the meaning must be. It means for me that, for example, I am in a very comfortable chair when I think about my faith, my beliefs. And I'm not comfortable when I am with my ideas. That is, at the field of the ideas, I am absolutely sure that I am not sure. That is the only good thing which I think we can do is not to be too much sure about the certainties. And the less we are certain, the more we can become certain. But concerning my beliefs, I confess to you, I never had need to rethink about that. I am in peace, but with this. But I am not magical. No, I am not fanatic. But I am not a theologian. I never studied systematic theology. And maybe this is one of the reasons why I can commit heresies. And it is very good. I am a theologian as well as all the believers are. It's not necessary to go to the seminary to study theology in order to be a theologian. It's necessary just to have faith. If you have, you make theology in your way, but you make theology. You don't need to ask the Pope for permission to do that, to the bishop, Episcopalian bishop. But I insist on saying that. For me, it's a tremendous contradiction to accept the teaching of Christ without putting it into practice. I think that the only way I have to read Christ is to experience Christ and not just to memorize the Gospels. And experiencing Christ means to fight against injustice. For me, it's impossible love without that. it's impossible. Charity before justice. I first have to be just. And after that, I have charity or not. It's another chapter. No? Then I cannot understand a Christian who discriminates the others. Racism, exploitation, domination have nothing to do for me with a Christian, serious Christian position, which coincides, in my point of view, with a very serious and deep and revolutionary position. But what we are trying to do, all the Brazilians, whose dream is like ours, that is, to get a better time for the masses of the people in Brazil, what we do is to fight politically in order to change the system in Brazil, to start pushing the system, trying to transform it. That this is our dream. And we know that it cannot be it cannot be made inside of our heads. No, it has to be done in history, socially, with the people, as subjects of this change. But every time we have chance, we try to change a little bit the system. Right now I am giving, I personally am giving a little contribution to the system of education of the state of Pernambuco, which is my state. I live in São Paulo, but I was born in Recife, which is the capital of Pernambuco. But now in Pernambuco we have a different people in the government. That is the people elected a left man. The same man who was in the government when the coup d'etat came up and he was put in prison. And he came back after the that is when the open began in Brazil, and he was elected now. And then we are doing what we can do in order to make better the system. The system in Pernambuco, as well as in the other states of Brazil. But the whole system of education in Brazil will be transformed when we also can transform the global system of Brazil. This is the situation of your country also, which has today, we experience a tension bigger than the tension we have in Brazil. Your generation has many things to do.
What do you think of, instead of trying to change the formal education system, lie the fact that that seems to be the last change, as we talked about earlier, in all countries, even though they have a revolution like Cuba or Zimbabwe, the educational system stays the same. It's the last to change. Since that's a fact of it could hardly be questioned or disputed, it'd be questioned, all right. Wouldn't a better approach to be what they're doing in Nicaragua, try to start a popular education type of program outside the existing educational system and use that to build support for new educational ideas? Mm-hmm. There's much more freedom to grow and expand and develop a system there than in the schooling system.
Yeah.
Would you think that would be a...
You know, Mario, how I react to that? I think that it's a mistake of Nicaragua. If Nicaragua, with all my respect for Nicaragua, and for the people who made the revolution, and I did not make the revolution in Nicaragua, then they have the right to. But unless it is a tactical policy, is it right? In my point of view, we had to do both these things at the same time. And do you know, because of that, I think, precisely because Nicaragua, under a tremendous and violent regime, about 40 years, could not do anything unless prepare the revolution, the system of education in Nicaragua maybe has still lots of resistance to change after the revolution. But to the extent that we can work on some, to the extent that we can fight in Brazil against the rigidity, the traditionalism of the anti-democratic aspects of the system of education today, we are not wasting time. On the contrary, we are gaining time. Mm-hmm. In order for us tomorrow to have less resistance to change the formal system of education. And in the case of Brazil, I think that there are excellent conditions, because we are having today changes, very important changes inside of the public system, mm-hmm. in some areas in Brazil, and we have a fantastic work in informal education. That is what we do in Brazil, not myself personally, but what lots of people do in Brazil, all over the country, at the field of popular education, is fantastic, is something incredible from the point of view of the quantity also. But I think that the more we make pressure on the public schools in the order for then in the subsystem of education, in the order for the subsystem to become less rigid, the teachers become more progressist, more competent by fighting. For example, it is so beautiful that you have in a city like São Paulo, for example, hundreds and hundreds, all the teachers of the state, not exclusively of the city of São Paulo. And São Paulo, just the city, has 10 million inhabitants. And the state is a country, no? And 2 or 3 years ago, all the teachers of the public system were in strike against the government. All during 1 month, criticizing the government, demanding better salaries and the conditions for them to become better teachers. Then it is very important, and it is also a sign that tomorrow we can change the school with this kind of teachers. Do you see that? I never consider the teachers as something bad. That is, as teachers we become bad because of the concrete situations in which we are. Right. But on the other hand, I you are right. I will do the best to work out of the schools in order to make pressure and to help the changes inside of the school. Mm-hmm. But I never would close my eyes to the public schools, never. Because they first of all, they are a real existence. They are concrete as this chair. They exist. And then what I have to do is to change the schools. And it is possible. I know that it's not easy.
I think one reason Paolo has such faith in the school system is because he's such a good teacher. And he thinks he he knows he has done things within the system, and he that gives him hope that other people can do that too. But I share philosophically the idea that we have to recreate the schools, public schools. I've never thought of alternate schools like Howard as being a substitute for schools, but a tactical way of working, like I think popular education is a tactical way of working and to bring pressure on the schools at the same time doing an authentic educational job in their own in their own right.
But just a moment, because for example, I am sure, Miles, I am absolutely sure that even though you did not work inside, you did not create a school, you are first in the history of education of the century. You are, no matter, some people did not say yet it, but it does not, the next century, this century, in the sense today, from today to the end of this century, many voices will repeat that you are one of the most important thinkers of this century in education. And I insist on saying thinker, because I have nothing against it. Against thinking. Because for me, thinking does not exist without acting, but without action. You are a thinker, and a very good thinker. And you brought into education such a quantity of challenges, of innovations, of confirmations. You belong, Miles, you belong to a very old and new movement in the history of education. Since 200 years ago, you are one of the representatives of this movement. No matter you are working out of the schools, but the repercussion of your thought, sooner or later, will be emphasized inside of the schools. And because of that, I think that you did the best and it was fantastic. Because maybe if you had done what I did, you should be less efficient like me. No, because I worked since I was very young, I worked on the two fields. I was a teacher when I was 19 years old. I am stopping now. But I also worked in the slums of Brazil informally. I became a professor at the university and I continued to go to the slums. But I worked on the two fields. Maybe I learned less than you, because if you stayed in. But anyway, I think that at least it's important to emphasize the importance of the private level, the public schools, and to change them. Okay.
Both of you all have had a chance to sit in hundreds of such experiences all over the world, but I'd like to hear from you what, from these experiences and this discussion, you've learned, or what further questions you have before we leave, to keep us learning.
What did I learn? I learned again the fantastic taste of learning. Don't know whether it makes sense in English. But for me, learning is something, it is an excellent meal. Even though I don't like the parallel, because we don't eat knowledge. Maybe I go to another symbolism. For me, learning is like making love. And it makes possible a certain fantastic taste. You know? And I would say to you, I cannot dichotomize knowing, eating, living, creating from sensualism. For me, it should be impossible. When I come to my books, it's almost a meeting among people. When I eat, I love to eat. It does not mean that I eat too much. I have my limits. I love to eat. And I am very, very afraid of people who don't like to eat. People who don't like to eat can kill us. No, it's important to eat, to live. And then I learned today again how beautiful is to learn, is to relearn. It is, I confirmed today also, it's another beautiful thing for an educator who has worked a lot like me in different countries, in different cultures, different situations. That is how the people are able to know. The other thing which I found beautiful is that all of you here were not afraid of assuming the responsibility of being educators. Because I am also very afraid of some kind of educators who come to speak and say, look, I am not properly an educator. I am much more a colleague. We are educators, and then we must educate. But the question is, in educating, we become educated. Also, this is the question, but not to reject it, to be an educator, to be a teacher, not to reject it, to assume the responsibilities which the teacher has to have. For example, I learned something about the geography of these regions. I did not learn something new concerning my knowledge about philosophy, about education, about sociology. No, because every day we are not learning something new about that. But I relearned lots of things, and I am very happy.
You know, there's another person who was involved and had a foot in both camps, John Gavetta.
He was the bridge, in a way, you know, between the academia and whatever Holler is. He's connected with both.
I don't feel like a bridge. I feel the analogy I have in my mind is going down a river with one foot on different logs. Back and forth, but today I feel good because I think I can stand up with my feet a little closer together. And I guess I've really, you know, I think when I've worked at Highlander for the last 12 years, I got involved in Highlander not because of my academic background, but because of work I was doing in communities. I first came to Highlander 15 years ago as a community activist, trying to learn how to use research and knowledge up near Jellicoe in a way that would help empower people, and that's how I got here. And I always felt the academic part of me was something, in a way, I left behind, in a way. And that's because I think, and I've learned this from Paulo all week, we have been taught so long in this country to think intellectual activity and theory and all those things go together with academia. And the important thing is that oftentimes as activists, we end up downplaying the importance of knowledge and theory and reflection because it's been monopolized by the wrong people for so long that we've thrown it out and we've thrown out the baby with the bathwater, you know, as a result. And and I guess it was only in the last 2 or 3 years that I began to feel just as a very personal level that, if in the process of helping learn from people like Maxine and Barbara and Ann and everybody else, if we're doing those things out there at the same time, we are not beginning to try to change that real mainstream institution that's constantly reproducing knowledge. They're out there producing new knowledge, but meanwhile back here there's 25,000 people getting knowledge fed to them, a different kind of knowledge. Then ultimately their battles, they're not going to win unless we can begin changing the reproduction of knowledge as well as the production of it. And I guess that's why I thought, well, I'll try putting a leg down there at UT. And I was very excited yesterday because I thought that was a new step to see so many people in that monolith talking about these ideas, 200 and some odd people. And then to have that continue here today. And so I've learned a lot from Paulo and from Miles this week as they have debated this, what I think is really a key question of our time, and that's how we break down the dichotomy between, we talk all the time about breaking down the dichotomies between the has and the have-nots and the blacks and whites and men and women. And we all know that part of that is the dichotomy between the educated and the uneducated and the academed and the non-academed. And until we really put those dichotomies out there and figure out how we break those down along with everything else, I don't think we're doing enough.
But for me, what is important is to go beyond this dichotomy between practice and theory, which always helps the power in power. The more we accept the dichotomy, the more we help power in power. I am convinced about that. Then, if we reject intellectualism, we also cannot accept basism. That is, we have to work with the openness concerning these two. But I have to ask you to forgive me because I did now something which I would not like to have done, say a speech. But I was challenged by the last words of John.
That speech was really unnecessary because we've had the experience here of seeing the embodiment in Paulo Freire of theory and practice. A unity of theory and practice is embodied in him. What he was saying to us in all these words, he's the embodiment of. And for those of us who are used to people who either are theoreticians or practitioners, both crippled by not being part of the other, Paul combines in a dialectical way these two things in himself. And it's a treat for me every time I have the privilege of being with him, I'm just, edified by being in the presence of a person who unifies in his own way of thinking and acting, theory and practice. This is probably the rarity of the age.
Thank you.